From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. As a lifelong Mormon, the playwright Eric Samuelson sees it all the time in his church, this pressure to keep up appearances. The church can be obsessed with public relations, he says, and this is not just the pressure to conform, to believe, but to show that you have a perfect marriage and perfect children, and for women, that you're the perfect mother and wife. Samuelson's latest project with the Plan B Theater Company is three short plays with different characters and different storylines, but they're tied together with this theme of perfection. It's his attempt to peer into what he calls the darkest closets of his own spiritual home. Today in the program, we're talking about the plays. Together, they're called Three. Join us after the news.
Hi, this is Elaine Clark, one of the producers of Radio West. Our free podcasts are made possible by KUER's generous listeners. If you're a fan, we hope you'll consider joining them. Become a sustaining member of KUER for as little as $5 a month. Visit us online at KUER.org for details. Thank you.
This is Radio West and Doug Fabrizio. The latest production of the Plan B Theater Company is an evening of three one-act plays written, as is the whole season, by the playwright Eric Samuelson. It's called Three. And it's based on the experiences, the perspectives of Mormon women, mostly. One play explores the sense of suspicion some of you may have felt with your Mormon neighbors when they come calling. Are they here to be friends, or is there another motive? Another of the plays is about that irony of how women can be objectified in religious cultures and the hypocrisy about pornography, how it plays out in theory and then, of course, in practice. The third features an LDS woman who has married a gay man. Eric Samuelson says all of them are bound by this pressure within Mormon culture and other cultures, frankly, to be perfect. Today in the program, we're talking about the plays. We invite you to join us if you like. If you have comments or questions, 801-585-WEST is the number. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Eric Samuelson is a playwright, a director, a critic. Plan B Theater Company has dedicated the entire season, as I said, to his work. And Eric, welcome back. Thanks for being with us.
Good to be here.
Cheryl Ann Clough is directing the play this time around, co-founder and managing director of Plan B Theater Company. Welcome back to you.
Thank you.
We have Stephanie Howell, who plays, gosh, a lot of people, Brandy in Bar and Kel, Janelle in Community Standards, and Cheryl Lynn in Duets. And Stephanie, welcome back to you.
Thank you.
Teresa Sanderson is back with us. She plays Bar in Bar and Kel, Chris in Community Standards, and Candace in Duets. And welcome back to you.
Thank you, Doug.
And Christy just walked in. Christy Summer Hayes plays the role of Kel in Bar and Kel, Bertine in Community Standards, and Sandra in Duets. And hi.
Hi.
Thanks for joining us. Well, we should mention Three opens tomorrow night. We'll give you the details about that as we go along. So I wanted to start with all of you. That's why I introduced all of you, because I wanted to get your sense about this question that I've been thinking of, and that is, do you think, Eric, I guess I'll start with you, is there a myth of the Mormon woman? You know, this impression that people have about the woman who's, you know, oppressed or simple-minded or the Stepford wife. I mean, is there a kind of a myth out there about the Mormon woman?
I think there may be outside the culture. Yeah, there is that myth that
that's kind of what I'm talking about outside the culture.
Because women in the LDS Church don't have the priesthood. People who misunderstand what priesthood means in a Mormon context think that equals oppression and therefore that Mormon women are, you know, downtrodden in some sense. But that never made sense to me growing up, and it still doesn't. My wife and her sisters, I'm very close to all her sisters, and they're incredibly strong, independent, intelligent women who are capable in many, many ways. My mom was a school teacher and a real educational innovator. But a lot of it for me comes back to my grandmother, who was Utah Mother of the Year a couple of times. She was a university professor. And so I think it's very much a myth that Mormon women are repressed or suppressed or put down. I think within the culture what happens more frequently is that Mormon women are put up on a pedestal and seen as better than men in some very real sense, that women set a standard for righteousness and goodness and good behavior that no mere man could possibly live up to. Yeah.
But we're going to come back to that. So I want to get the rest of you the sense of the way Mormon women have been portrayed. Has it bothered you, or has it interested you the way that – Christy, what do you think?
I have a similar experience that Eric has, in that I grew up with a lot of really strong women who were very involved in leadership in the church, who never seemed submissive to me. So this person, and I think it's true that the idea of priesthood within the Mormon church tends to have a very different definition than it does, say, like in the Catholic church, where it's a profession somebody chooses to do and the women don't have that choice. It's sort of a volunteer, you know,
right.
You say, yes, I will do this. And you do basically everything you do in the church for free. It is not a profession. And it's something that every male has as sort of a almost a rite of passage sort of thing, or a way of maturing. Whereas we look at women's journey as being a little bit more inherent to womanhood, I guess. So it has been a little baffling to me too, but I think that outside point of view just comes from a point of view of the world at large, and not really having that insider's.
Yeah. Cheryl, what do you think?
Yeah, I definitely agree that there's that perspective from outsiders that Mormon women are oppressed and downtrodden. But I agree with Eric. I don't think it's necessarily the case. All of the Mormon women that I know are very accomplished and smart and are not downtrodden or oppressed in that way.
Yeah. Right. What do you think?
I guess I kind of am coming from it from more of an outsider's perspective, and I do think that myth is there. And I think I would wonder, I understand what Christy and Eric are saying about the priesthood, but I guess I would want to ask, isn't the priesthood, isn't that power? Isn't there some kind of power that's inherent within that? And if, doesn't that by definition make there a kind of some sort of inequality within that culture?
So they have less power?
Mm-hmm. I'm just asking. I am coming as more of an outsider, I think.
Teresa, what about you?
Well, I too know very accomplished, very happy Mormon women. I live in a very LDS neighborhood. My neighbors all seem to be happy and fine. But I have to say, the question that Stephanie raises is one that I've asked myself. Yeah.
This is so interesting. It must have been really fascinating as you guys were putting this play together, the conversation. I'm not sure if you debated much, but you must have talked about all this stuff, right, when you were putting the play together?
A lot.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
Was that important, Cheryl?
It was important to talk about it. Not that we thought that we had the answers to everything, but we wanted to explore where did this idea of the perfect Mormon woman come from? Yeah. Is it in the doctrine? Is it in the culture? And where did that really start, and where does it come from? And it doesn't seem like people really say that out loud within the church. You've got to be perfect. You've got to, outline this perfect idea. But we just really tried to get a better understanding of where it actually comes from, and we don't have the answer yet.
But it informs
play,
the way you express
yourself. It informs the play, yeah.
But I think that's more universal. I think that it's not just within the Mormon culture that pressure for women to be perfect. I think that's not unique to Mormon.
Yes. Yeah.
Was that surprising to any of you that you realized, oh, wait, this isn't just a Mormon thing. This is
no. It wasn't surprising to me.
Yeah,
no.
Yeah. What about you?
No, I don't. It didn't surprise me at all. I'm not from. I'm from Indiana, so most of my friends growing up were not LDS, and I saw that pressure all the time. The you can have it all. You should try to have it all. You should be amazing at 50 different things, which are really not reconcilable.
How dicey is it to be a man writing a play about women?
I am. I am constantly aware of the fact that I'm a dude writing women, you know. And in fact, that was one of the things I said in our very first rehearsal. I said, if there's anything ever that doesn't sound like the kinds of things women would say, you know, tell me, and we'll talk about it, we'll fix. And Christy had the only one, I think. I think you pointed to one thing that didn't, to you, ring true as a woman, and she was right, and we fixed it.
So you've been thinking, I mean, you've written these plays. It's been years since you've been sort of tinkering.
It's a 15-year process, yeah.
How did they – what got you thinking about – I mean, at what point did they sort of come together as a theme? I mean, and when did you decide to put them together as a theme?
That's a great question. I'd always been very interested in the whole question of Mormon women and Mormon feminism. I mean, that's always been something that I've cared a lot about. But the first one, Bar and Kel, basically just came from observing women in my neighborhood as they made this one less active woman a project and kind of involved themselves in her life. And I thought, not necessarily with a particularly good result. And what it seemed to me was that the women in my neighborhood and in my ward were kind of glossing over some really quite serious issues that this woman was having.
Yeah.
And so I thought, well, that makes for a good play, you know. And I wrote it, and then I don't know where the names Bar and Kel came from, but that just sort of happened. And so that was then. And then within a couple of years of that, there was this pornography case in American Fork.
Yeah, yeah.
And I was so fascinated by that. And I'd already written one play with three women. And I thought, I wonder – part of what fascinated me was just the technical challenge of putting a full jury trial – with, you know, 12 jurors and lawyers and judges and witnesses and all that, of doing that with just three actors.
So as opposed to 12 angry men.
Exactly,
three
yeah.
Women.
With instead, you know, three angry women, I suppose.
They kind of are. Yeah, I guess.
And I love that technical challenge. And yeah. I thought, well, that'll be fun. And about the same time, there was the whole controversy over Titanic. Should Mormons see Titanic as an R-rated movie, and so the
because there was a pretty tame
little scene in there, yeah.
Scene of woman,
and then they started selling edited copies of it so that you could see Titanic without the Kate Winslet nude scene,
yeah.
That seemed oddly enough to kind of fit in with the whole pornography thing. You know, it seemed so interestingly revealing about Mormon attitudes towards sexuality, Mormon attitudes towards women, and the objectification of women that I think is just absolutely inherent and born. So,
but then of course there's that sort of inherent fact too that per capita Utah is the biggest consumer of pornography.
We were just talking about that actually before you came in. Yeah, absolutely. That the pornography is a thing. You know, it's an issue within our culture, and. I didn't do a lot of research into that particular trial, just basically what I could read in the papers, because there was a hung jury. There was one juror who would not go along with the rest of the jury in it. And I didn't want to tell her story. I didn't want to interview her. I just wanted to make stuff up.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah,
so
you're a playwright. Yeah.
I'm a playwright, yeah.
The third one I want to come back to, because I want to ask about for all of you acting, the physical challenge of transforming yourselves. And I mean, not just three characters. You play multiple characters, more than just the three I mentioned. There are these little supporting characters that you play from time to time, too. Teresa, physical challenge, this play?
You know, I love this kind of stuff. It's one of my favorite things, to be able to snap back and forth into those characters. So for me, it's really a lot of fun. It's been fun finding all those different voices. And I get to, especially in Bar and Kel, kind of look at it from both sides, because I play Aunt Dot and Bar, who just could not be more opposite about their opinions. So it's been really a fun challenge for me. I've enjoyed it.
What about you, Christy?
I probably enjoyed it less. you know, I I have found that it's made me look at people a lot more closely in my life. So there, I think I've been staring a little too much and listening to how people speak and what they're. I mean, not that I don't.
But to come up with
the
character, is that what you mean?
Yeah, because there's a lot. There's a lot. Not only do we have the three main characters, but we have to play men, and you know, and it's been a really interesting exploration of my own voice. Like trying to find the range in my own voice and having to go back to, you know, all of my vocal training in the past to get more range out of my voice. So technically it's been just physically a challenge, but it's been fun in the end.
But hard.
Yeah. Not easy. I'm not as good as Teresa at it. So
yeah, what about you?
I'm with Teresa. I love doing the multi-character kinds of work, but I think for me it came, at least for the three main characters that I play, I started with Eric's words and sort of the voice that, and each of them is pretty distinct, the way that they speak, the words that they use, and from there I think the physical aspect of it grew out of that.
Yeah, because it's good writing.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's always a good start. What about the kind of emotional or the mental challenges of this? And let me ask you that question in this way. You all have varying relationships with Mormonism. Some were involved with Mormonism in the past. Some aren't anymore. We don't need to talk about all the particulars unless you like. But I guess the point is, what difference did that make to the way you approached these different kinds of roles, the themes of it, you know, that your own perceptions of it, your own sense of it? Christy?
Well, I feel happy and grateful that I do happen to be a Mormon woman who has experienced the Mormon culture, because I think if I came into this trying to understand that culture, it would have been a much longer, harder process. Now, having said that, you know, the definition of prejudice is to say that every Mormon is the same. And so, you know, I grew up in that culture, so I know we're all vastly different, with different points of view and different ways of approaching not only our religion, but our lives. And, you know, we have different personality types and all that. But I did have that advantage to say, look, I am one of these women, and I know that my religion is not the only thing that defines me. I'm a human being first. Mm-hmm. And so that's how I approached it.
Yeah. How about you?
Yeah, I think I did too. Approached it from a woman's point of view first, without it being from a really a Mormon point of view. Even though I was raised in the church, I'm no longer active. But I'm with Christy. I know a whole bunch of really strong, wonderful Mormon women. And I took some of that, and I took some of things just from being a woman out there in today's culture. And again, Eric's words. I think, you know, you go back to text and it tells you.
But your experience with Mormonism in the past, that helped you relate to some of these characters, right?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Yes. And yes, and many of my very dear friends are still active LDS.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
And you see them reflected here on the page?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. That's what's uncanny probably for a lot of you.
I think so.
Sort of put, oh, this is Susan.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah. Yeah.
I know this, but I think every neighborhood has a bar. I mean, right? I think every neighborhood does.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, just somebody who knows what's happening and who needs help and when to be there and what to do.
Yeah. And you always wonder about the motivations.
Thank goodness for them.
Yeah.
Yes,
yeah.
But thank goodness for them in times of need.
Yeah. Stephanie?
Ditto. I don't think I have anything to add to that.
I wanted to ask about... Eric, you've used some pretty strong language here, and I wanted to ask you about it.
Okay.
When you were writing about the play in a blog post for this production, you write this, that LDS culture, you say, is deeply rooted in sexism and of patronizing patriarchy. Pretty strong words. Explain it. Deeply rooted. Does that mean inherent in?
I don't think it's inherent in the religion. I think it can be inherent in the culture. Yeah, it's a patriarchal culture. And the issue that Teresa and Stephanie pointed up about priesthood, the rhetorical stance is that men having priesthood equalizes them with women because women are able to have children, are able to conceive and have children. But that in itself seems patronizing. That it in itself seems
a cop out.
Yeah, kind of a cop out. Yeah, so as a male in the culture, as a priesthood holder in the culture, as an active member of the church living in the culture, I still have to come to terms with feminism, and I still have to and what I've chosen to do is to define myself in terms of Mormon feminism. I consider myself a Mormon, but I also consider myself a feminist. And so I'm able – and I, as a member within the culture, I have a little bit of an outsider-insider thing because I'm not actually from Utah. And the sexism I see in a lot of Mormon Utah culture, I don't really see elsewhere in the church, at least not to so pronounced a degree.
That seems like an important thing to say, that yes, there are universal broad issues here related to women, but this is about Mormon women after all.
That is. It is, yes.
Because that seems to dilute it a bit, to be quite honest, to say that this is broadly, generally about the women experience, but this is about certain women. This is about particular stories. It's a piece of art.
It is about particular stories and particular specific women. But, you know, we've all been saying here, Mormon women are strong, Mormon women are bright, Mormon women are accomplished, Mormon women have great capabilities. But if women are 50% of the population, then there are a lot of Mormon women and a lot of women generally who are jerks. Right? There are a lot of...
I am sometimes.
Wow. I mean, I don't want to re-pedestalize.
No, that's what I want to say, because there are some questionable things that go on among the characters in this play. That's
definitely
crucial, which we'll get to as we go along. Cheryl, I wanted to ask you something you had said. You said one of the reasons you wanted to direct the production was that you wished there was less fear in the world. What did you mean?
Right. Well, I think that this propensity to be hyper-perfectionists and the propensity to conform, and I think it's based in fear, and the fear of appearing outside the norm, the fear of appearing wrong, and the fear of letting other people find their own happiness. So that's what I found very appealing about doing this show.
We're going to talk about the plays themselves when we get back from a break. That's Cheryl Ann Clough. She directs the play Three. Eric Samuelson wrote it. He's been resident playwright with the Plan B Theater Company this season. The actors, Stephanie Howell, Teresa Sanderson, Christy Summerhayes. I'm not going to do the characters again in the names. I may do that later. Plan B Theater's Three opens tomorrow at the Rose Wagner Performing Arts Center. It's Eric's final play for the season. Runs through April 6th with matinee and evening performances. Tickets are available through ArtTix. You can get all those details on our website, RadioWest.KUER.org. We'll take a break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're profiling the latest from Plan B Theater Company. It's a production of three short plays, each of them devoted to the issues about modern Mormon women in particular, about all women generally. The playwright Eric Samuelson is with us, so is the director Cheryl Ann Clough, and the actors Stephanie Howell, Teresa Sanderson, Christy Summerhayes. The show opens tomorrow at the Rose Wagner Performing Arts Center. We'll give you the details about that as we go along. So, Cheryl Ann Clough, Barr and Kel, lay this out for us. Barr is Barbara Bartlett and Kel is Kelly Franson. Set this up for us, the idea for the play itself.
Oh, okay.
Who they are.
Well, Barr and Kel are two very active LDS women, and they have decided to intervene in the life of Brandy, who is also LDS, but the very definition of less active, as right. One of the characters says. She's got an abusive boyfriend, and she has three kids and one on the way.
She's from the wrong side of the tracks.
Yes, yeah. Yes, less educated and So they decide to make her their project and help her along. And the thing that I like about Barr and Kel, and Eric has said this in rehearsal, is that, you know, that in a lot of ways, they really do help her and make her life better. But in some ways, maybe not so much. So, you know, I think the audience will need to decide what they think about how Brandy has been helped.
Eric, talk about this was something you had seen in your own neighborhood somewhere.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
And what was the question that interested you? Just the idea of what is it that's motivating this help?
Yeah, I mean, it's this idea of making somebody your project. We're going to make this person our project, and we're going to make her over. We're going to change her life, presumably for the better, which, you know, is in fact rooted in a charitable impulse and rooted in a positive impulse. I'm going to choose this woman who I see is struggling, and we're going to see what good things we can do for her. And as Teresa pointed out one night in rehearsal, at least Brandy gets a much nicer house out of it.
Yeah. Some training,
they
job.
I mean, she gets at least a set of new shower curtains. I mean, that's not nothing.
And the drawers are organized, trust me.
And the carpet shampoo.
And she's made good progress toward her GED.
Yeah, and I think the play makes it clear that Brandy does not have a high school diploma, and that because of the intervention of Barr and Kel, she's making progress towards a GED. Again, that's not nothing.
No,
that's,
well, it's all about good intentions, right?
Absolutely.
I mean, they have these. Maybe if they're impure, but they have these intentions anyway. But then Aunt Dot comes into the scene. Teresa, talk about that character. You play her. You say you know an Aunt Dot, or you know of you know various Aunt Dots in your life.
I know an Aunt Dot too in my life.
Yeah.
Yeah, maybe I am an Aunt Dot too. I'm not sure.
Well, explain what that means, because she's the truth teller, I guess.
She is the truth teller. She comes in and says to these women, "Okay, so you get her married, and then what? Does that make him stop cheating? Does that make him stop hitting her? No, none of this makes it better. I just think it's always good to have that equalizer in the room that says, wait a minute. Why are you really doing this? Who is it really helping?
Yeah. And what do you really care about?
Yeah.
Because what Aunt Dot says is what you really care about. Come on, guys, be honest.
It's
the property values.
That's right.
Yeah.
How it looks. You care about how it looks, not how it is.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Cheryl, do we need to set the scene up? I want to hear a scene here. I mean, this is basically this idea of what it is that's motivating these women kind of comes out.
Okay, this scene is between Brandy and Kel, and they have become real friends, developed a friendship through this process of being projectified. That's a new word. And this is a scene in the park as they're sitting there and their kids are playing together. So.
Here's a scene from the play 3.
Now, I'm going to ask you this straight out, and I want you to answer me honest.
Okay.
Why are you my friend? Why do you spend time with me?
And I truly did not know what to say, because Barr told me to. No, don't even think that. That's not a good way to be thinking.
Well?
Because you're our project, because once I was Barr's project, and now I've grown beyond that to become her equal and her partner, and we decided to do this together, raise you to our level, help you become like us, happy like we are. I could say no such thing, of course.
Tell me straight, why?
Because I want things to be better for you, I guess. Because I like you. Because you're a good mom.
You think? A good mom. Ain't none of them pregnant yet.
Well, she's only 7. Give her time.
And that Sunday.
Sorry, Bart. Yes, that Sunday, after 4 months of nearly daily visits,
babysitting trades,
long chats at the park,
rides to the local high school where Brandy made good progress toward her GED,
a breakthrough,
Brandy and Kenny came to church.
Brandy!
I ain't been in one of these places in like 10 years.
Okay, Brandy, just stick with us.
Your girls look great.
Where do they go?
For the first meeting, you can all sit with us. After that, there's primary for the girls.
They'll be with our kids. They'll be fine.
Don't worry about a thing. They'll love it.
How do I look?
You look fine.
And in fact, she did.
Kenny had really made an effort, too. Bolo tie, his nicest cowboy boots.
And best of all, he wasn't chewing anything.
And one Sunday led to two, and two to four.
It was amazing.
We worried about the bishop.
The marriage thing.
I told the bishop how to handle it.
We're Mormons, and Mormons marry, but too much pressure could drive them both away.
I told him all that, but you never know if they're
going
to listen.
We did feel it would be better for him to wait. Hope they'd marry. Give them the chance for further growth and a letter of the law kind of approach they'd neither understand nor appreciate.
Turned out we were right, of course.
It's interesting. It seems like such a triumph, right? For and but then Kel wonders. Yeah, what is the thing she says? She says, was I helping her or just trying to feel better about me?
Yeah, yeah. I think Kel is a little bit more in touch with what her real motivation is than Barr. Barr is very task-oriented.
Yeah.
She wants to get stuff done. And Kel, I think, has a more introspective nature and really can't help but ask herself, now, wait a minute. What is my motivation here? And if she's asking me to be honest with her, if I were really honest?
Yeah. Eric Samuelson, you said that the play is about what could be the complicity of women in their own marginalization. Is that getting at that here?
Yeah, I think so. I think to some degree that's true. I mean, I was thinking that in terms of other debates going on in the culture right now.
Yeah.
But I think, yeah, to some extent that we're all a little bit complicit in our own marginalization. We allow things to happen.
I want to shift gears to community standard. This seems particularly apt, I guess, given that these kinds of stories seem to pop up from time to time. They always seem to come from Utah County. There's the story of the woman.
Now, I live in Utah County, so be careful.
I'm just saying, there's an LDS woman there recently bought up all these T-shirts that featured these racy images from of scantily clad women from a shop in Provo. So did that story seem pretty apt to you?
It did. Some accountant is looking at that particular store's sales figures for that particular T-shirt and thinking, well, that's a popular one. We've got to send out way more of those. I don't know that it was terribly ineffective as a strategy. But is there something kind of wonderful about that? I think of this woman and it's kind of easy to laugh at it. And I think even late night comics had fun with it. And yet at the same time, she's genuinely concerned about, you know, young people seeing people wearing these T-shirts. I think there's something both beautifully naive about it and also really awfully naive. You know, I mean, it's a both and.
Yeah. Well, I wanted to talk about the storyline for this play. Cheryl, talk a little bit about this. This is basically, as Eric was mentioning before, it's the essence of it takes place in this jury room where they're working out this obscenity case, basically. There's Janiel. Describe Janiel. She's the kind of she's the conservative.
She is the conservative, and she might be the one that outsiders might put the myth of the Mormon woman on, but she's not. Yeah. She's got, you know, a lot more going on than the myth, and she comes to realize some things about herself and her own marriage as a result of this trial. Very interesting character.
Yeah. Now, who plays Janiel?
I do.
Okay, so talk about Janiel, because she tells this story about how they loved, she and her husband sort of guiltily watched the Titanic, right? And it kind of gives them this sexual spark. Mm-hmm. And so she feels really conflicted, Janiel?
Conflicted about,
there's this kind of sexual, tell me about the character, because, I mean, there's this kind of, it's this weird relationship with her husband and sex.
I don't think she realizes that her relationship with her husband is weird.
Huh.
I think to her that she does definitely come smack face to face with the fact that that he doesn't view her as an equal or maybe even as a person. that he does objectify her. And so she does come face to face with that. I don't know that she sees that as weird in any way, sadly.
Maybe it's just the way things are.
Yeah.
An acceptance of it.
So she doesn't have an awareness of it? She seems to come to a kind
of
awareness.
Oh, she definitely comes to an awareness of it. But I think leading up to that, you know, when she and her husband see the Titanic, and I don't think that she has any, at that point, knowledge or self-knowledge about.
And she's sort of that, who's that, the Simpsons character that she's terrified for the children, the priest's wife in The Simpsons? She has that, she's terrified for the children. That's what Janelle is worried about on some level, right? I mean, she has that sort of impulse that pornography is just this horrible thing, and it's going to make me dirty, and it's going to ruin me.
Yeah. I think she does have that impulse, and she does. I think she's afraid of what watching it will do to her, whether it will change her.
Right.
And as she says in the play, it does change her, but. Yeah. Doesn't change her in the way that she expected it to change her.
Yeah. So there's Chris, who's kind of the liberal in the crowd. She's the non-Mormon, works for an internet security company. Good liberal, good. Who's Chris?
I play Chris.
Feminist.
Yeah.
Full of righteous indignation about pornography and how it objectifies women and things, right?
Yeah. But I think, too, she's more balanced. She sees both sides of it. She's lived outside of the state. She thinks that this trial is going to be cake. She thinks they're going to go in and view these films, and everybody in the jury room is going to go, well, that's offensive. Let's do away with that. And she's faced with something she did not expect.
Right. Which I want to get to. Bertine.
Hi.
Bertine is just I like Bertine a lot.
I do
actually.
Too.
Tell us about Bertine. She just sort of speaks her mind.
She does. Bertine, what you see is what you get, and she just thinks this is all ridiculous. You know, she thinks first of all she was the one who edited the nude scenes out of Titanic,
right?
And she thought that's so stupid. It's some dumb little nude scene. Get over yourselves. You know, this is dumb. And then when the pornography comes up, she's like, this is boring. Let's just get this over with. Let's get it out of our community. I don't think that she hates the pornography so much because it's disgusting. She hates it because it's boring.
Yeah. It makes no sense. All this writhing around just doesn't make any sense.
It's like, what's the point of that? Yeah. I got stuff to do. Get me out of here.
Which I think raises something we should mention, Cheryl. These plays are funny.
They're hilarious at times and also a little heartbreaking at times. But there's a lot of humor. You'll laugh a lot. Yeah.
Well, let's. I want to have you do a scene where they're sort of watching these movies, because it raises some questions I want to talk about before. Here's another scene from Three. This one is Community Standard.
Time to watch some movies. I'd seen films like this before, of course. My first husband used to like me to watch them with him. We'd be traveling together, staying at a Marriott or some nicer hotel where you can see them in your room, and he'd order one. For me, they didn't have the effect that he wanted, so I'd end up reading a Harlequin romance or something so I could keep up with him. I'd say I'd seen no more than a dozen, and it had been some few years.
They're just a bore. I just don't get it even a little bit. This is going to sound stupid, but what they really remind me of is that video game, Mortal Kombat. I mean, what's the appeal? Bad guy shows up, your guy fights him. If you win, another bad guy shows up and your guy fights him. Well, these were sex instead of fighting, but every bit as boring.
So demeaning.
Ain't no real person in the history of the world actually look like that, not without surgery.
I've worked with men my whole life, and I've never been treated with anything but respect. I do not get this at all.
Found myself looking for surgical scars. Read somewhere they put them right under the boobs. I'm looking.
After about that fourth film, the first day, I really did start to get angry.
What about the guy behind the camera? What kind of pervert would do that for a living?
It's a good thing no man tried to cut me off on the freeway afterward, I'll tell you that.
Boring, boring damn films.
I kept praying for it to end. For those images to be wiped from my mind, for the Spirit of God to bring some peace to my mind. The most private, the most secret parts of my marriage, moments of intimacy that only Jack and I shared ever, made ugly and disgusting and ridiculous. This was something between two people who loved each other. Our children, our precious little children, came from that. Oh, God. Dear God, please don't let this change me. But it did, of course, in ways quite unexpected.
I've certainly seen enough.
Come on, 3 straight days of it? They could at least given us some popcorn.
The third day. A close-up. The face of one of the girls. The camera just held there for a moment. I looked in the eyes of one of the girls, and she was up there acting. She was a very bad actor, which is, I think, why I saw what I saw in her eyes. And I realized it. I act too, just like she does, when she does, act as though something that's sometimes pretty uncomfortable and certainly not always wonderful is the single best thing in my life. Act the part, the hottest chick with the greatest lover. And I realized that, see, I'm pretty, I guess. The girls in the films are all pretty, and I've always been pretty. And me being pretty has always been really, really important to. After each of my children were born, Jack would set a mark, a goal. 105 I had to get down to. A weight goal, he'd call it. And if I didn't make it, he'd scream, and he'd and sit-ups. It was important to do sit-ups, work my abs, because the loose folds of a turn-off, a real turn. He'd tell me that in church on Sunday, he'd look around and check out the other women, and he'd say, "You're the best. A couple of others give you a run for your money, but you're still the. And we talk. We do talk about the budget or getting a new car, and we'd talk, and then he'd, whatever he wanted to, he'd buy the new truck the day after we decided we couldn't afford. Did he ever listen to me at all? For a second, did he? 105, weight goal. And he'd say, "Some women really let themselves go, but I don't want that to ever be said about my best-looking chick in the." I'd step on the scale, and if I didn't meet the, he'd, "You fat pig. Fat pig. Fat." I'm one of them. I am. A girl in a movie like that. That's what I realized.
Eric Samuelson, before we head to a break, I wanted to ask you this. For Janiel, I guess then, so the real question is related to this case that they're working over. Isn't what the community standard should be. It's what the community standard is.
That's right. That's the discovery that Janiel makes. But she makes it from her own life experience. I don't believe that all Mormon men objectify Mormon women. I don't believe that all men objectify women. But she doesn't know another world. And that's the world she reflects when she makes that call. In her mind, the objectification of women by pornography echoes the objectification of women by men in her culture, in her life, and in her marriage.
I really admire the character for speaking out like she does. It can't be easy for her to do that and to be honest about the reason why she's, you know, voting the way that she votes on the jury.
That's Cheryl Ann Clough. She directs the play 3. Eric Samuelson wrote it. It's been resident playwright for Plan B Theater Company this season. This is his last production, by the way, folks. We have with us the actors Stephanie Howell, Teresa Sanderson, and Christy Summerhays. 3 opens tomorrow night at the Rose Wagner Performing Arts Center, and it runs through April 6th. There are matinee and evening performances. You can get tickets through ArtTix. That's 801-355-ARTS. Just go to our website for the details, radiowest.kuer.org. We'll take another brief break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we are profiling the latest production from Plan B Theater Company. It's Eric Samuelson's collection of 3 plays called 3. opens tomorrow night. We'll give you the details about that as we go along. Eric is with us, along with Cheryl Ann Clough, who directs the play. We have the actors Stephanie Howell, Teresa Sanderson, and Christy Summerhayes with us, too. So, duets. Eric, this is the one, if, as I understand it right, this is the one that's sort of the most recent play that you've written, or based on the most recent set of events?
That's right. When I had the other two plays, I thought it would make for a full evening if I had a third play to go with it. And I actually wrote one, and then when Jerry Rapier and Cheryl and I were having discussions about the season of Eric, that third play just didn't live up to the standard of the other two. It just wasn't as good a play. And so I dumped it and came up with duets. And I thought that this issue of gay men married who choose to marry women had never really been treated from the point of view of the women involved. That coming out story, I think, is almost a cliche in the world of drama. But I don't think we'd ever seen it from that perspective, from the perspective of female friendship and the sharing of confidences that's about. So I thought I'd try one.
It's interesting. I don't want to give too much away about this, but the part about a woman choosing to marry, because in some ways she knows,
yeah.
This is Sandra, by the way, and Cheryl. Let's just talk about the storyline. Candace is one of the characters. She's the director of music or whatever it is for the ward choir, right?
Yeah.
Music director, and so she's recruiting
ward music chair.
There you go.
I'm ward music chair.
Yeah, we have to get the terminology right here.
Sorry. Gosh. Cherilyn is a member of the choir. Sandra has an amazing voice, and so Candace is trying to recruit her, but Sandra is this sort of private character and she's married to, as we learn, a gay man. But I think that one thing that, and we'll talk about that, but what interested me about this storyline is, in some way, it was as much about Cherilyn and her capacity to be a friend, to have integrity, as it was the gay storyline.
Yeah, it became that. Yeah, I think Cherilyn's the protagonist, and I think the play is about the degree to which she's going to continue to be a friend to somebody who has made a choice that she finds shocking.
Let's have you do a scene, if you would. Cherilyn, do we need to set this up?
No.
We've laid out the characters.
Between Cherilyn and Sandra.
And they're sort of feeling each other out at this point.
Yeah, and Cherilyn is kind of... When I talked about fear earlier, I was thinking about this character, and she craves beauty, and she doesn't like things that are about herself or other situations that are ugly or messy. And this scene helps illustrate how she kind of glosses over something that is a little bit messy about Sandra.
Here's another scene from Eric Samuelson's 3.
So, tea? You drink tea?
Herbal tea. I looked it up. It's not against the word of wisdom.
I guess. It's really good.
I love it.
I've been meaning to ask you something for a long time.
What?
Your name.
Oh.
I mean, not Sandra, Sandra with an O. Is there a story there?
It's embarrassing.
So there is a story.
It was my dad. He named me after...
What?
Clint Eastwood's girlfriend.
Clint Eastwood's girlfriend?
Sandra Locke. She was in a bunch of his movies, The Outlaw Josie Wales, Every Which Way But Loose.
I haven't seen him.
Oh, I have. That's my namesake up there. I've seen every movie.
She was gorgeous?
Not really. Sort of a washed out blonde. Pretty, I guess, in sort of an abused girl way. Plus.
What?
Well, she basically took her top off every movie.
Seriously?
Yeah, pretty much every film. I think maybe that's what my dad liked about her.
Okay, that's creepy.
You never met my dad. So, I had some issues.
I'd never have known.
Well, it's not like
when
I'd
you sing,
go around.
It's so beautiful. That's all I can hear or think about, just that.
Maybe I can sing a little because I'm messed up.
I don't believe that.
Well, you're sweet.
I can't do anything.
Of course you can.
Nothing beautiful.
You're a good friend. To me, that's beautiful.
That's the other thing I found really interesting about this, Eric, is that
yeah.
she, Sherilyn doesn't think she can do anything. I mean, this idea of her self-worth is really another one of those things that comes out.
That's absolutely right. She loves beauty and she loves beautiful things, but every time she tries to do something beautiful, it backfires. She's not good at
Well, she's not good at baking or sewing or singing or blogging or gardening. Any of the things that she really sees as part of a beautiful life, she is not successful.
And she loves all that stuff, but she isn't good at any of it. But I think Sandra's insight, which is to be a really good friend, if she were able to do it, would be better than all those things.
That would be the most beautiful thing.
That would be actually the most beautiful thing she could do. Yeah. But it's interesting to me, this just occurred to me just now, but Stephanie plays Janelle, who is, I think, the most courageous character of all three plays. And she plays Sherilyn, who is probably the most cowardly.
Yeah. I don't give that away, though.
Sorry about that.
Let me ask you this finally. We're pretty much out of time. How has this, doing this play, changed your own impressions, all of you, of Mormon women? If it has. Cheryl mentioned, I know, in some place I read, she said it's given her more of a sense of empathy in some ways. But what about for the rest of you? If it has.
Yeah, I think that when you're an actor, you have to subjectify yourself to the people, and you have to try to understand them and really love them. Ultimately, is what you do, because when you understand somebody, you love them.
Yeah,
in my experience, so I think that it has. I mean, I think that I've always sort of had some of that anyway, but it's enlarged that, and it's made me look a little bit deeper, and just in general, just loving the human race.
Yeah, let's all be a little kinder. It's hard out there. I think, you know, let's just love each other. And I think that's what this brings home for me, too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think when you live in someone else's skin, even if it is someone who is cowardly at times, you gain a sort of empathy for that. And for I feel that way for all of the characters.
Yeah, and for their struggles.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Cheryl, final word?
Come and see the show. We've got tickets for Saturday. So please,
Well put. Cheryl Ann Clough directs the play. Three, Eric Samuelson, he wrote it. He's been resident playwright with Plan B Theater Company this season. This is his last production. The actors, of course, Stephanie Howell, Teresa Sanderson, Christy Summerhayes. Thank you all for being with us.
Thanks, Doug.
The production opens tomorrow at the Rose Wagner Performing Arts Center. As Cheryl mentioned, you can still get tickets through ArtTix, 801-355-ARTS, or just go to our website. We have the particulars there, radiowest.kuer.org. Radio West, a production of KUER News, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Eileen Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.